WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Last night, a new platform was adopted by the Democratic National Convention. The preamble calls for a revolution in government to take power away from entrenched bureaucracies and narrow interests in Washington and put it back in the hands of ordinary people. Well, who are the ordinary people? Are they the middle-class voters the Democrats so desperately want to win back? My guest Nicholas Lemon writes about the urban poor and social policy. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic. His book, The Promised Land, The Black Migration and How It Changed America, is out in paperback. Recently, Lemon started to write about the middle class. I asked him if he thinks the Democratic Party is emphasizing the middle class at the expense of the urban poor.
The Democrats politically are doing the right thing in going after the middle. In the short run of American history, the middle class has become convinced that any government efforts to solve problems of poverty are going to be at their expense and are going to be kind of nutty schemes that waste money and that give people, poor people, cash to sit around and do nothing all day. That's really not true, but it's very effective as political rhetoric, and the middle class now believes it.
You think it's not true that the middle class loses out when the government creates programs to help the poor. Why do you think that's not true, and why do you think that perception that it is true exists?
Over the long term, the American middle class has been, I wouldn't say hurt, but is going through a transition. Now, middle class is such a broad term in America. It really applies to about 80% of the people in terms of who identifies themselves as middle class. The American middle class, vaguely defined in this way, had an incredible run from about 1945 to 1970. It didn't look that way at the time, but in retrospect, it was a period of just tremendous, unprecedented, mounting prosperity. In which for millions and millions and millions of Americans, really the vast majority of the country, things got dramatically better economically and in other ways over a long stretch of time. I don't think any period of that kind can last forever. And indeed, that period ended around the time of the OPEC oil embargo, so that indicators like the average person's income or average family's income, which went up very dramatically in the 50s and 60s, have since then leveled off and grown only very modestly or not at all. So you have a middle class that is in shock over this kind of leveling off of the growth line. When you have that happening, you tend to look for somebody to blame, and there are various villains that present themselves, all of which are appealing to different people, such as the Japanese, special interest lobbyists. But certainly in that panoply of villains, one is the poor. In other words, I think you can say to the American middle class, this terrible thing happened. Now, what was going on just around that time, why it was the Great Society and the War on Poverty, and what that consisted of was taking away your money and giving it to poor people, wasting it on welfare. Now, that's not true. That's a tremendous shading of the truth. But as a kind of a myth, it seems to make sense to people emotionally or to be emotionally satisfying.
You know, at the Democratic Convention, Barbara Jordan, for instance, talked about how we weren't going to be the tax and spend party anymore. She said the Democrats were now going to be the investment and growth party. What do you think of this whole, we're not going to be the tax and spend party anymore? What do those words mean to you as compared to investment and growth? Do you think the Democrats are making a linguistic change, or do you think there really is some kind of fundamental shift happening there?
There's some shift happening, although a lot of that is just linguistic. First of all, every party is a tax and spend party. I mean, governments, all governments tax and all governments spend. All governments that are democratically elected skew their taxing and spending policies in favor of the coalition that elected them. And, you know, the Reagan administration and the Bush administration did exactly that, and Democrats tend to do that too. So tax and spend has been turned into a wonderful piece of Republican after-dinner rhetoric that sounds like something everyone is against, but actually most people, if you examined it closely, would be for taxing and spending of some kind. So I think politically it's a very good strategy to say we're going from tax and spend to investment and growth, but actually people should, you know, hear that rhetoric. I mean, it's very unlikely that a historian of the future will say, yes, 1992 was the year the American government stopped taxing and spending. Of course it'll keep taxing and spending. That's what governments are for.
I wonder what you think of the Democratic platform plank on welfare reform. And let me just read a few lines of this. Welfare should be a second chance, not a way of life. We want to break the cycle of welfare by adhering to two simple principles. No one who is able to work can stay on welfare forever, and no one who works should live in poverty.
I think it's good. I think it's both good in a political sense and it's good in a policy sense. The real question about welfare is, if you get to the actual thing itself rather than what people think it is, this vast program that eats up half of the federal budget, nobody likes it. Nobody's ever liked it since about 1960 or so, with a few, very, very few exceptions. There was a brief period of vogue for a guaranteed annual income, which exists in other countries. But basically, you're talking about a very unpopular program. So the question is, why has it survived this long, and why hasn't anybody come out and said this before when it makes so much sense, in both the political and policy senses? And I think the answer is there's some sense that, you know, people will be offended if you put work requirements into welfare. But I think the real issue is, and this is a cynical thought that doesn't make its way into the mainstream of political debate, but I believe is there. The one place that you find it stated directly is in Senator Moynihan's memos to President Nixon in the early 70s. Welfare is cheap. It's a cheap program, and it's a cheap way to buy a little bit of social peace. And I think that the reason nobody has taken on the welfare system to date is that there isn't much to be gained by spending more money than that on entrenched inner-city poverty, because it's unpopular spending, and there's a feeling that this is probably the least expensive way to do something about the issue. Virtually all the alternatives, including the Democratic one, if it's put into practice, will cost more because you're adding jobs programs and other services to the current system of just mailing people money.
Tell me what you like about this welfare reform plank in the Democratic Party.
I don't think welfare should be a way of life either. And I think that it's obviously not worded with tremendous specificity, as these things rarely are. But I think I read it as a promise of a government job as a replacement for, at least in the short term, for living on welfare, which I think is a great idea. Especially long-term welfare recipients tend to be people who live in all poverty areas, and they're very cut off from the mainstream of American society, job networks, job skills, work habits. What they need the most, I think, is something that brings them into closer touch with, you know, mainstream American life. And if you had a government jobs program, if it's run right, that would be an ideal way to do it, because it gets people out of an urban slum into another place and into an experience of having a regular job. And I can see how that could easily lead to getting a job in the private economy and getting out of the slums, which should be the goal.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nicholas Lemon. He's been writing about the urban poor for many years. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine and author of the book The Promised Land, about how America was changed by the Great Black Migration. That's just come out in paperback. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Nicholas Lemon is my guest. I wonder how middle of the road you think the platform really is. You know, this has been billed as the, you know, the middle class suburban middle of the road Democratic convention, and yet last night there was a gay man who's HIV positive talking about how proud he is to be gay, which is really unprecedented.
You won't see it at there. I was having a sort of fantasy as I was reading the platform of what you'll see people get up and say at the Republican convention. You won't see that at the Republican convention. I can see somebody getting up and saying, you know, the Democratic Party's platform calls for, endorses the National Endowment for the Arts. There's all sorts of sort of conservative applause lines waiting to happen, hidden away in the Democratic platform. They have been very careful to avoid, you know, the most obvious ones like welfare, liberal, things like that, crime, things that were the buzzwords in 1988. But certainly, you know, they are and want to be the party that feminists and gays and minorities and poor people will feel comfortable with, and that's obvious from the platform.
The L.A. riots happened really shortly before convention season. Do you think that they've really had an impact on the political debate?
Remarkably little. It's almost as if it didn't happen. And the reason is every party wants to... you may see the Republicans talking about the L.A. riots a little bit if they dare, as the product of failed Great Society programs, but they've been batted down on that, I think, pretty effectively. And I think the Democrats are afraid to talk about L.A. because they don't want to be perceived as the, you know, black urban poverty ghetto riot party. And they think that if we talk about this as a problem, we're going to be linked to it as a problem in the voters' minds, and that's what we don't want. So you have a very odd situation where the worst domestic disturbance in many years just happened. I mean, the one thing that really can be held up as evidence of severe trouble in the country more than anything else, and there's a kind of entente not to talk about it in the context of the presidential campaign. Very odd situation, which, you know, makes sense if you know the whole history of how the Democratic Party lost its presidential majority and so on, but it would just seem odd to an outsider that a huge, obvious, terrible thing happened right in the middle of a presidential campaign that's supposed to be a referendum on the country's troubles, and it doesn't come up somehow.
On the whole, do you think that what the Democratic platform has to say about the urban poor is on target? Is it adequate?
Well, I'm torn there. I think that urban poverty and is really the worst domestic problem in the country, and various other problems flow from that, such as crime, schools, race relations, and so on. I think that's really the key to everything. But I'm you know, grounded enough in the real world to know that if a major national party gets up and says, our entire goal, if elected to the White House, will be to focus on urban poverty in a country that is, you know, probably three-quarters middle class and over half suburban, would be political suicide. So I don't think, you know, that the art of politics is striking some kind of balance, and it doesn't have to be a cynical balance, between what needs to be done and what you can persuade voters to go along with. And I think that the Democrats are doing a pretty good job of that. And if they are weighted on the side of what people will go along with, it's understandable because this is a party that has been losing presidential elections for 25 years.
Nicholas Lemon is a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine and author of the book The Promised Land. This is Fresh Air.